Welcome to This Is Money podcast. I'm Georgie Frost, and joining me and editor Simon Lamb today is deputy editor Lee Boyce. And a very happy new year. But is it though? As banks hike mortgage rates and leave savers in the lurch, it's been weeks since the base rate hike, but easy access deals remain at rock bottom. Have banks abandoned savers? But are better times ahead in 2022? Also today, don't call us landlords. More chances to bag Avios points. What pips Tesla as Britain's favourite car? And looking to change careers this year? We reveal the top paying jobs and how to land them. Don't forget, you can stay up to date with all the latest breaking money news. Just go to thisismoney.co.uk or download the app. But first, a happy new year. Very quickly, Lee and Simon. New Year's resolutions, anybody? Lee, how's it going?
Yeah, my New Year's resolution, Georgie, was to not wave at the end of Zoom meetings that we have.
Very good resolution. Yeah.
You wouldn't wave in a normal meeting and say goodbye to people, but unfortunately, I did it by default yesterday. Mm-hmm. So 6 days in, yeah, breaking my New Year's resolution, unfortunately.
I don't think you've ever waved to me in a Zoom meeting, Lee, but I won't take it personally. Simon?
Not really a great one for New Year's resolutions, in all honesty. However, I guess if I was going to come up with them, I thought about maybe not procrastinating. Procrastination is the enemy of many things, and it's a definite enemy of mine, which combined with my innate distractibility can cause problems. So I'd like to stop procrastinating and just do it. Just do stuff.
All right. So just do it. I hadn't really thought about it, to be honest, until I just asked you now. So I've got nothing to add to this conversation.
Well, don't procrastinate, Georgie. Come up with a New Year's resolution right now.
Read more. Read more actual books.
Not read more internet.
Yeah, exactly. So me doing nothing, very similar to what the banks have done with regards to savings. Let's go there now, shall we? Surprise, surprise. By the way, if you do have any good New Year's resolutions to give me some inspiration, let me know. Yep, surprise, surprise. We get a base rate hike. Mortgage rates go up. Savings rates, well, they do basically what I did. Nothing at all. They barely budged. Nationwide recently hiked the rates on 238 mortgages, with some up to three times more than the base rate rise. As for savers, well, zip. And they aren't alone, though, nationwide. It seems banks have forsaken savers. But is there light at the end of the tunnel? Lee Boyce. Let's take a look at Nationwide first and the mortgage rate hikes.
First of all, I should say that Nationwide, as you just pointed out, is not alone in doing this. And it's not a surprise, really. You know, it was very likely that mortgage rates were going to go up in hand with a base rate rise. They've been at record lows last year. I mean, we've had some absolutely phenomenally low rate mortgages, you know, below 1%. I mean, that is quite incredible. Firstly, so I don't think it was any kind of surprise that mortgage rates are going to have to start nudging up soon. Otherwise, we were going to start seeing mortgage rates where we don't pay any interest. You know, it was getting that silly, getting that low. So totally sort of understand that. Now, the rate hikes that Nationwide, we focused on Nationwide here because Nationwide is a building society. Obviously, Nationwide is a very, very, very large building society when you compare it to its competitors. So I always think of it more as a bank. You know, the size of it is a massive spot. But because it has the building society spot, we kind of want it to do what's fair by its members. Now, in fairness, raising mortgage rates makes sense in a base rate rise, right? So there's 185 fixed rate mortgages that are going up and 53 trackers. Now, there's been so much fixing mortgages in the last few years that a lot of people, if you're a Nationwide customer, are likely to be on a two-year fix, a three-year fix, a five-year fix. You know, so you're going to be basically avoiding this rise because you're already fixed. And a lot of people were fixing last year, anticipating, especially the second half of last year, anticipating a base rate rise, fixing in, perhaps locking for longer than they might have done otherwise, which does carry its own risks in terms of porting mortgages and overpaying and all that kind of stuff. So you have to do your homework and work out what's best for you. So those people are going to be largely kind of, for now, avoiding any kind of rise. It's just what happens when you come to remortgage for those people. For people that are taking out mortgages, first-time buyers, you know, looking to remortgage at the moment, you're going to be facing higher rates probably if you're Nationwide or a customer of any bank. But the thing is about this, Georgie, and the reason why I think on the whole people won't be too fussed about mortgage rates nudging a little bit higher is, for example, let's say you had a 5-year fix, you've been in the same home for 5 years and you had a 90% LTV. With a house price rises, that might now be a 75% LTV. It might be a 60%. You know, you've got that much equity in your house now that you might be able to swallow these increases anyway. I think what hurts people is on the other side, the savers, the
people that want to what's going on there?
Well, this is what's going on there, George, is precisely what you say. Nothing. We've not seen any kind of movement of savings rates. We've not had any kind of news of, well, you're passing these hikes on to mortgage customers. So are you going to do this, the same for savers? Now, look, big banks have not been interested for a very long time in savers. They haven't needed it. They've had access to cheap money. They've had people clambering to get mortgages and borrow money. You know, it just hasn't been necessary. So we're at a time where easy access rates mostly are at 0.01% at big banks, you know, which is something we've spoken about a lot.
Yeah.
I think what irks people about Nationwide is that it's meant to be in the benefit of the members. You know, it's a mutual. I like building societies. In fact, I like building societies a lot. I think they're great. And they're great for local communities, the smaller ones. I think they do a great job. You know, it's a shame there's not a building society in the town I live in, because I would definitely save money with it and, you know, open an account and all that kind of stuff. Nationwide is just obviously such a huge organisation now that I club it now in more, as I say, with the big banks. And the big banks haven't passed on any kind of rises to savers. And we spoke to a couple of experts about this and, you know, largely saying, don't expect this base rate rise to be passed on to savers, essentially. But there are forecasts for more base rate rises potentially this year. And if there's another one, experts are saying that's when it's likely that savings rates start to tickle higher. But nothing too exciting, Georgia. We're talking still probably below 1% on an easy access and below 2% on a 2-year fix. Now, if you think about inflation, think about this cost of living crisis, which is going to be dominating the financial news this first half of this year, definitely. It's very, very hard to get a return anywhere, whether you're trying to get a return from Nationwide, one of the big banks, one of the challengers, one of the smaller organisations. Yeah, the challengers and the smaller building societies are probably offering more interest, but it's still nothing to do to combat inflation, to combat the cost of living crisis. And I think a lot of people are just incredibly fed up about that scenario, about trying to chase rates, trying to get some sort of return, a stable return, with their money protected in a kind of safe way, and they can't do it.
To play slightly devil's advocate, Simon, if the bank raises the base rate of interest, it passes that on to our banks. So you can kind of understand they'd make borrowing more expensive, but they don't have to give us anything for saving. So why should they?
I think banks and building societies, large banks and building societies, have been absolutely diddling savers ever since the financial crisis. And I think that savers deserve better. I think they deserve better from a building society, Britain's biggest building society, that advertises under the slogan, on your side, right? Okay. Building societies, the point of them is that they give benefits back to members. And Nationwide does. Okay. But in the pandemic year, okay, so to April 2021, this is its last full year profits, it made a profit of £832 million. Financial benefits back to members, which includes better savings rates, but also includes other things like better rates on mortgages and things like that, was 265 million. So that was below its £400 million target, which it said it wanted to get back to. So in the worst year for people's finances, Nationwide gave them less help. It made quite a bit of money actually though, but it gave them less help. Now, in the 6 months to September, just the 6 months, Nationwide's profits rose to £853 million for the 6 months. It's absolutely coining it in on mortgage lending at the moment, right? And also, for all this talk of low interest rates damaging bank and building society profitability and how hard for them it is to give people better savings rates when interest rates are low and hard for them to make money. Well, Nationwide's been making some pretty big profits, okay, as of every other bank and major building society. I'm singling out Nationwide because we're talking about Nationwide here and its mortgage rate rises. I could single out other large building societies. I could single out Yorkshire, for example. I could single out Lloyds Bank. I could single out NatWest. But Nationwide's net interest margin in the full year, the full pandemic year, bearing in mind that was a year in which interest rates were cut down to 0.1%, actually rose from 1.13% to 1.21%, and it then rose again by November to 1.24%. So I don't see any reason why Nationwide is raising mortgage rates and still thinks it's okay to pay people the best easy access rate that's open to everyone, any customer, 0.01%, and the best easy access rate that you can get as a Nationwide customer, okay, so this is their Flex Instant Saver, right, which is unlimited access to your savings, is 0.35%. I think that is poor. I think that is very poor, because that's only open to its members, the people on whose side Nationwide is meant to be, and it doesn't match the best accounts out there.
Which now, are I'll about, you, what, 0.65, 0.7?
About 0.6, yeah. Now, yeah. I'll give you the flip side of that. The flip side of that is that Nationwide is massive. Nationwide, if it was to put its savings rates to 0.6%, would see a sudden huge influx of money from people in a way that potentially other people offering 0.6% wouldn't, and it wouldn't necessarily be able to manage it quite as easily as other people offering 0.6%. Bear in mind, though, it's also pulled a perk this year, a long-standing perk for its current account customers, that it was only for legacy current account customers, because it stopped new ones getting it. This free travel insurance, that was canned. And that was introduced after they removed the fee-free spending overseas. In the meantime, the bosses at Nationwide, like the bosses at the other big building societies and the other big banks, are absolutely coining it in to the tune of millions of pounds a year. I can understand why savers are really, really annoyed about this. And effectively, the only reason that the banks and building societies get away with it is that savers have pretty much given up, and also, they just don't need their cash. There's so much cheap money sloshing around that they just don't need savers' cash. And this is actually true. There's a savings glut. There's too much money. There's too much money that savers have sloshing around the whole world, not just Britain. It is a problem. But I do think that savers have been taken advantage of since the financial crisis. A financial crisis that it should be borne in mind, in which we all stepped in to support and save the banking system. Now, if you're a building society, you might argue that, you know, you didn't need saving and you didn't take direct help and all that other stuff. But every single financial institution, certainly all the banks, all the building societies, benefited from the fact that the Bank of England and the government made it clear that they would do whatever it would take to rescue them. And we stood behind that as taxpayers, and our reward over the years has been to be chipped away at. And I think it's shameful. And I think that people in the banking industry and building societies should take a long, hard look at themselves and start thinking about maybe offering savers a better deal.
Well said, Simon. Feisty start to 2022. Lee, on the back of what Simon says just then, I'm not holding out much hope for 2022. Are you? For better times ahead?
Better times ahead in terms of savings or just in general?
Well, I mean, we could go general, but should we stick to savings? Where would that lead us? Who knows, but not in a 1 hour long podcast. Savings generally?
I think if you look at it over the course of the year, I think it's very unlikely that you're going to be able to get a return that's going to match or beat inflation, for one, which is not great news. And I think we will see rates nudge slightly higher, and especially if there is one, maybe two base rate rises, who knows. But it will all be fueled by smaller challenges, smaller building societies that kind of, you know, just looking to jump to the best, top of the best buy table to rake in some money, and then they'll quickly disappear. It won't be driven by any of the big banks or big building societies, because as Simon says, and as I said earlier, you know, there's been so much cheap money sloshing around that they don't really need savers cash. And they have to balance the books, you know, they have to have the right inflows, outflows, you know, it's a finely poised business. Like, you know, you have to have the balance right of how much you're lending out, how much you're taking in. But unfortunately, how much you're taking in is heavily influenced by the cheap money that they've had access to for quite a long time now. So yeah, sorry Georgia, I'd love to give you some better news, some good news. I reckon we might see NS&I raise a few rates, maybe potentially, but yeah, other than that, I just can't see anything happening that's going to really, as a listener to this podcast, go, yes, Lee's really gear me up here and say my savings are going to start earning me some good interest. I think the first thing to really think about, talked about New Year's resolutions earlier, is just get started. And as Simon said, just get started. You don't worry about the rates. You know, if you are someone that is being able to squirrel away a little bit of extra money, just get in the habit. Get in the habit is more important than the interest rate if you're first starting out.
That's true if you are just starting out, but it also, when you said it doesn't matter about the rate, it kind of does, right? If we're going to do something about this, and I don't imagine how much this is going to work, but don't just sit around on a 0.0001 account. Look around, find a better rate. No, move your money.
Oh, definitely. Yeah, I feel like I'm teaching people to suck eggs because I'm pretty certain that we have said this so many times over the years that I can't say that message anymore.
If you don't can, Lee. Cash, you can. Just keep going.
If you move your money, you know, if everyone moved their money from 0.01% and took it somewhere else, would it have an effect? I don't know. It's impossible to say, but, you know, do something with it.
Well, at least you'd get a couple of extra pennies.
Yeah, exactly. Getting a few extra pennies, or maybe start an investment, you know, portfolio, or just go and spend it down the pub, or do something with it. Like, you know,
energy bills.
You know, and actually, quite a lot of people are guilty of having different accounts all in different places with sort of small amounts and stuff. Just maybe make it your New Year's resolution to merge it all and stick it into one of the challenges, or at least into premium bonds or something. You know, don't just let it like flounder in these big banks. But I think a lot of people do leave it in big banks because, you know, it might be who they've got their current account with. They can see the money, they can keep an eye on it, and they just think, oh, just do that then. What's the point?
Simon?
And I should say, okay, I have just said that the big banks and building societies, and actually just all of them, really, have been diddling us since the financial crisis, right? But we let them diddle us. We allow them to do this. I'm letting them diddle me. I'm a Nationwide member. This is why it exercises me so much. I have got some money in a savings account, an easy access savings account there, that was put in there. It's only about 200 quid. And it's money left over from when my first daughter was born. And it was just some money that was lumped in. It's not her money, so don't worry. I'm taking my duties with her money more seriously. But it's money that was put into an account that, like, I said to my wife, like, just there's money there, just like, you know, whenever you're on maternity leave and you want to do something, you think, oh, I don't have enough money, use that money, right? Mm. Okay, and it's in a savings account that is labelled something like e-savings, not Titch or something, like, you know, what we used to nickname her when she's little. There's still 200 quid in there. She's 11.
Yeah.
And it's earning nothing. It's earning 0.01%. And I look at it and I think, oh, well, I should really move that. I should just put it into my daughter's savings account, for example, or just anywhere. I should have put some Bitcoin with it is what I should have done. But it's still there. I still haven't done anything with it. And I still think, and this, you know, what I just went on a rant about this and I'm letting it happen to me. Mm. But here's a helpful tip. Okay. This is from an article that our colleague, Rachel Rickard Strauss, long-term podcast listeners, remember Rachel from her time at This Is Money. She now works for Mail on Sunday, our sister publication, wrote at the weekend. Okay. And she got some advice from another Rachel Winter, Associate Investment Director at stockbroker Killick & Co. She says, investors should think of their savings and investments as three different pots. So the first pot should be your rainy day savings. That should represent 3 to 6 months of expenditure, and it's money that's easy to access in case you have any financial emergencies. Simple stuff. You keep that in cash savings. You get the best rate on it that you possibly can, but it's got to be easy access, and you know what, you're just going to have to lump low rates. The second pot should be designed to meet any foreseeable costs in the next few years. For example, a new car, a home move, the wedding of a family member. Now, she says this money should also not be invested and kept in a savings account. That's good financial planning. You might not want to do good financial planning. You might think, okay, well, I tell you what, maybe it doesn't matter to me if that money ends up down like 10 or 20%. I won't like it, but I can make that up from my salary, from my earnings. Okay. So, but if it's for a home move or a deposit, don't do that. Right. Okay. But maybe if it's for a new car or something like that, that you're like, okay, I can, it's just slightly discretionary or whatever. Maybe you could get away with investing some of that money, but in something low risk, right? This is me saying this. Okay.
Yeah.
Not Rachel Winter, who's saying you should keep it in cash. The third pot Rachel says, is your long-term savings, which you can afford to invest. If you're investing for several years, then stock market uncertainty is not going to affect you, as you can afford to ride it out. And if you've got a big pot of cash that's earning very little money, look at it in that sense and go, okay, what's my rainy day chunk of this? What's my second pot chunk of this? And that's the really important one to think about. The money that I might need, or that I have something planned for in the years to come, and how cautious do I need to be with that money? Can I afford to take any risk with it whatsoever? And then you've got the rest that's left over is the third pot, and that's the over and above money, and you should invest that money. Because, you know, over this long-term money, you're probably never going to dip into it. This classic question you ask people, like, what are you going to do with that money? Well, I'm probably never going to spend it. It's like, well, in that case, you should probably be investing it. And over the long term, past performance, which is no guide to future returns, but if you look long enough, it's a reasonable guide. But just companies' ability to make profits over the long term means you should get a better return on that. And we're moaning about savings rates in the 0.01% at the same time as the FTSE 100 went up like 14% last year. So, you know, now you can't guarantee it will go up this year. It might fall 14%. But if it's that third pot, you're thinking long term with it, and you're thinking 5 years, then you're probably going to do better than sitting in that terrible savings account and moaning about those mean old banks.
Yeah. So, Simon, then this time next week, where's that £200 going to be?
I really want to say not in that Nationwide account.
It's not going to be. Do it. Do
okay.
it.
That's back to my New Year's resolution that I made up on the spot. Do it. The anti-procrastination one. Okay.
There you go.
Right. Done.
There you go. First test of the year. Okay. Right. What's in a word? Well, rather a lot, according to buy-to-let property owners, or should I say rental accommodation providers. They want to drop the title landlord. Landlord. They don't like it, apparently. But does it really matter? Does it matter, Lee? As the man who once wanted to be an estate agent when he was little, you would have dealt with a lot of landlords. What is in the name? Does it really matter?
It would be nice if they kept the word landlord rather than small housing provider, because that's going to play havoc.
Roll off the tongue, doesn't it?
It's going to play havoc with headline writing otherwise.
Yeah, right.
That's too many characters. They're going to have to come up with something, you know, shorter than that and snappier than that, because that don't sound good. I think it's just...
What's the problem? What are we talking about, Lee?
It's been the last 5 to 10 years. I think that landlords have been lynched, all clubbed into these sort of bad people, you know, that are sort of property barons that own all of these homes and, you know, don't treat tenants correctly and all of that kind of thing. And it does feel like there has been more and more of that. Maybe it's social media, you know, maybe that's been played a part. But, you know, usually it's just a few bad eggs among, you know, a quite professional industry, you know, that has industry bodies, and a lot of landlords might only have one property, two properties, you know, depending on how they got that property, you know, it could become accidental landlords, that type of thing. But I think there's been sort of various people in the last sort of decade or so that have given it a bad name. I can't remember the name of the guy that, I think he was Kent based, that had all of those properties.
Oh yeah, I remember exactly who you mean. What is his name? Yeah,
Fergus Wilson.
That's it.
Just little, you know, little things like that that get into the press, and then it starts to, you know, snowball into more stuff. But, you know, at the end of the day, landlords have not got it easy. You know, you have nightmare tenants. There's like all sorts of regulation that's coming in over the next few years that's going to make it trickier to make a return. All sorts of EPC targets. Mortgage tax relief removed, you know, all of that kind of stuff. It's not an easy ride, and I've said this before, I don't think I could ever become a landlord or a small housing provider, because I've just heard of the stress.
Or rental accommodation provider, that's also another option that we can call them here.
Yeah, because I've known people that have done it, and the stress involved to me just doesn't seem that worth it. I mean, it's great to have a property portfolio, especially if you look at what Halifax are saying over the last year. I mean, £24,500 added to the average property in the last 12 months. I mean, that's pretty tasty. And we were talking about mortgage rates just now. You know, if you are a renter, cobbling together that deposit is, number one, tricky. Number two, it's difficult in our red hot market to find a home that you can buy when you're competing with people. And three, on the whole, especially if you're in London and the South East, you realise that mortgage payments are probably less the rental payments, and that's quite upsetting. But that's not the thought of a landlord. They're not going to, you know, reduce rents because it would be cheaper than a mortgage. They're just going with demand, supply and demand, and that's the thing. So I think that they're looking, this report basically suggested that 3 in 5 landlords would like to be called something else, almost like a rebrand. I had this image of like a marketing agency coming in and giving it like, you know, we were landlords, but now we're, but I can't think of a better name. I can't think of another word. And apparently in America, some US media organizations are stopping using the term landlord because of complaints.
Can we call them like rentors or something?
Rentors. That sounds like something out of Jurassic Park.
Rentors.
If there's any,
would they be then we'd be rentees.
I'm not sure.
On that. It's better than small housing provider or
Because what if you rent out large houses?
Well, then that's where you're called a rental whatever provider.
Large housing provider then?
Rental accommodation provider. That's more broad brush. But, you know, as you say, Lee, it doesn't work for the headlines, really.
No.
Simon, is this a bit silly? Do you get the point?
I'm just imagining us sitting doing this podcast in 50 years' time. Looking back and going, I can't believe we used to be so offensive that we called them landlords. What were we thinking?
50 years, Simon. It won't be 50. All right, then. So Simon, just briefly before we move on from this, because I want to ask views about most of the subjects we're talking about for 2022. What does it hold in store for the rental market? Lee there said, look, they've had a bit of a bad, rough ride of it, some landlords, from government taxation, but also in the press, etc. Some justified, a lot of it not. What do you reckon, just generally the rental market?
It's been red hot in some places.
I know.
Certainly, you know, causing people a few problems in terms of renters who are having to move. Rental inflation, by some measures, is running at about 8%, which is a big, big, big jump, because when you consider how much money you actually spend on rent. So obviously, we focus on food prices, we focus on energy prices, we focus on petrol prices, but people spend more on their rent each month than they do on those individual items. So as an individual item, if it's rising so rapidly, then it's a major problem. In London, not so fast. In fact, in certain parts of London, depends where you are, people have been able to negotiate quite hard and you've seen rents fall. That stalled at the tail end of last year. And I think we'll probably start to see a turnaround in that. I think we're seeing a bit of a, you know, the shift back to the city mentality, to be honest. So I think it is tough for landlords. They face a lot of extra costs. One of the big ones that is rolling down the hill at them at high speed is this energy efficiency thing of getting their properties up to a decent energy efficiency rating, which is very difficult for a lot of properties in the UK. And is going to be an issue in many years to come. And it's going to, this whole energy, green energy transition is going to suck a huge amount of capital out of the market, out of everywhere, basically. In terms of, you know, financial markets, there's going to be a huge amount of capital that needs to be sunk into renewable energy, into shifting from old-fashioned dirty energy. And we're stuck in the middle of that problem at the moment, watching energy prices go completely bananas too. But from a, you know, homeowner perspective, people are actually going to have to start sinking money into improving the energy efficiency of their homes. And I think if it's your own home, you can probably hold out for quite a long time and be very reluctant to do it. I mean, it might cause you a bit of a problem when you sell, but realistically, how much attention do people really pay to that when they're selling? It's much easier to put the squeeze on landlords by saying, look, hey, you know, when you want to get a new tenant, you need to be hitting this. Otherwise, you're in trouble, sunshine. And they are going to need new tenants at some point, even the ones with long-term tenants. I would say, though, Lee's right. There's a lot of really good landlords out there. There's a lot of landlords who look after their tenants. There's a lot of letting agents who look after their tenants too and make their landlords look after their tenants. And if you can find them as a renter, then you've done well. And as a landlord, if you can find good tenants too,
indeed,
you've done well as well. So it's a kind of mutual beneficial scenario.
Indeed. So be nice to each other. Is this a sweet spot time for earning Avios points? American Express and British Airways have launched fresh offers for new and existing card members. They're aimed at customers keen to get away more this year and give their Avios points balance a hefty boost. Oh, travel. No expensive tests, fears of cancellation, last minute changes. We can but dreamly. I'd look at my Avios points. I didn't even know I had any. I wasn't looking at the Avios points. Apparently I'm a member of BA something or other, and I've got 11,000. Can I travel somewhere far with that? No. Okay, fair enough. Probably a good thing then, because I'm probably not going. Actually, I don't know, Lee. What do you think in terms of travel for this year? Aren't we coming out the other side? How many times have we asked this over the last couple of years? But what do you reckon?
I reckon with those 11,000 points, Georgie, you'll be able to go to far-flung destinations around the world. No,
step outside my front door and then back again.
Yeah. You might be able to get an off-peak Europe flight, maybe.
Get out! That's not bad. I didn't even know I had them, to be fair. So
really lucky. But you might have to
look
around for that. what's in store for travel? I think that there's a lot of people who are absolutely desperate to get away and have a holiday and probably thinking this is it now, this is the year, but there's so many variables. I mean, with the Omicron thing that happened the start of December, you know, that news end of November, start of December, to put panic in people again, you know, might put people off again, and then we've got all of, like, you got a test before you go, you don't have to test before you go, you got a test before you go, you got a test before you come back, all of that kind of thing.
Do you, don't you?
Exactly, you don't. Yeah. Oh. I mean, I'll be honest, I had my first overseas holiday last month. And it was worth every single penny testing of a little bit of anxiety before we went away. Those 10 days we had away were just absolutely so good for our health, the sunshine, the mental health, you know, everything around it. I'm so glad we did it. And yeah, the testing was pretty, you know, added on to the holiday. But the holiday that we booked was probably half the price it would have been if it wasn't for people dropping out and not the demand not being as strong as it usually is. So there's all of those kind of factors at play. Again, I think it's one of those things that a lot of people will probably be waiting for after April. You know, maybe that Easter holidays when things will start to pick up a bit more again. But it's still worrying time in the travel industry. I think, you know, who knows is the answer. I mean, I say that, and then this week, when the markets reopened on Tuesday, airline stocks and travel stocks absolutely soared. I mean, they were right up there in the FTSE 350. So, you know, perhaps there's better times ahead. I've seen stats this week as well with the new rule changes that a lot more people have been searching for flights and holidays. So, who knows?
I think some people have just been ploughing it on ahead, regardless, being one of them. But be that as it may, whatever happens to travel, let's talk Avios points. Tell us about them. Are they any good? I don't know. I've asked this before, right? People love them. Absolutely love them. These stories do so well on your website. That's why we talk about them. So there's some good news if you like to earn these points.
Yeah, quite often at this time of year, there's good incentive bonuses for joining and signing up. And usually these bonuses are doubled at this time of year. So, for example, on its British Airways, American Express card, you get 10,000 bonus points instead of 5,000 bonus Avios when you open. Now, there's all sorts of small print to that. You've got to spend X amount of money within the first 3 months. They always have sky high APR. You know, you have to play by the rules of the game, and that is pay it off as you go along. Don't leave money sitting on there. Don't leave debt sitting on there. And then also, if you're already a cardholder, you can invite a friend, and they're going to get 12,000 Avios for doing that. And some of them are, you know, incredibly generous. And we always speak to Rob Burgess, and I should give him a shout out here because he always helps us with these stories. He's the founder of Head for Points, which is a really good website. And he's saying that these are exceptionally generous offers, this new wave, that they're around till the end of February. And they can be great. If you do your everyday spending on it, you know, it's a way of getting rewarded. So I'll be honest, I collect Avios, and I'm an accidental Avios collector, because a few years ago, we went on our honeymoon, we saved up, we went business class. We actually, from the back of that, got so many Avios from it. I was like, I should really start building up that pot. And it became a bit of a challenge.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, real boring personal finance journalist guy, kind of how many points can I stack up? And I've just been using, I had the gold card, signed that up for the first year, which is free for the first year, and then I cancelled it in year two because it's like got £140 fee, and the pandemic was kind of unfolding, and I was like, I'm not sure how much use I'm going to get out of that. So I just switched to a fee-free card, and I just get one Avios point for every pound spent. So I've just been stacking them up. Went on that holiday last month, that got us more Avios points.
I just hear they're so hard to spend. Anyone tries?
Well, I was getting like that. Yeah, the sting in the tail, Georgie. Yeah. And also, even Sainsbury's Nectar now, you can convert them into Avios. So those are good ways of collecting points. And of course, the big way people used to collect points, especially before the pandemic, was having a business issued card and doing lots of business travel and stacking up Avios and just going on this continuous loop of getting companion vouchers. And you know, you read all these stories about how people stack these up. But I say once again, if you are interested in doing this, you've got to play by the rules and you've got to pay it off as you go along. And the second thing, as you just rightly pointed out, they're quite difficult to get your head around how to spend them and how to make the best use of them. So have a good look around, have a good read about how to do it, because they're, you know, you want to get the best value pound for your Avios points. Mm-hmm. And we might have mentioned this before, but this reward flight finder website that I think is fantastic, and it's also an app. Basically, you can have a look, you just put where you're flying from. So if that's London or Manchester or wherever you are in the country, you type in a destination and it will come up with a year view. And it will show you how many points and how many seats are available for certain dates. It's really handy. I find it so much more useful than the British Airways website for having a quick look, roughly seeing how many points it will take you to get to places. But really, to go somewhere long haul, you're probably looking, for two of you, you're probably looking at six figures. You know, which if you're having to do that for a point for every pound spent, well, you know, that's a lot of money that you've got to spend to get that. And that's why going on flights that qualify for Avios, and that's why business spend and all that kind of stuff, that's where you really get the big points from. You know, if it's just your regular everyday spending, it does take a long time to build up a good point, a good pot. But people do it. People love it. People play by the rules and do it. And if you've got any tips, if there's any listeners that are like, you know, got some real top tips, let us know what you do, and we'll give you a shout out next week if we get some good ones.
All right, well, that's the planes. We're not talking about the trains, but we are going to talk about the automobiles now. Tesla is the UK's second favourite car after becoming the second most bought new car in 2021 after... Simon?
The Vauxhall Corsa.
A Vauxhall Corsa, yes, indeed.
Yes, but... in at number one, knocking the Ford Fiesta off top spot.
Thank you.
A top spot better. That it has had for many, many years is the Vauxhall Corsa.
Thank you. That was what I was after. You were a bit slow on the uptake, but we got there in the end. But forget cars, Simon, because what was it? What vehicle sold in the highest number? It was...
van.
A van.
A van. Get a van, you can start earning.
A Ford Transit custom van, apparently.
Indeed.
It has been a tough year for the new motor market, though, with chip shortages and the like. So, Simon, tell us more.
Okay, so this is a little tale of how... what's happening with inflation in the world, and an example of pandemic-based inflation insanity changing the cars that we buy in the UK. So the UK's top-selling cars, we've got the Vauxhall Corsa number one, Tesla Model 3, the Mini, the Mercedes-Benz A-Class, the Volkswagen Polo, the Volkswagen Golf, the Nissan Qashqai, the Ford Puma, the Kia Sportage, and the Toyota Yaris. And the Ford Fiesta is nowhere to be seen. In fact, there's been a major shake-up of many of the cars in here, and it's all to do with the chip shortage. This semiconductor chip shortage that has been suffered across the motoring industry, and across all industries actually, but the motoring industry has suffered quite a lot because it uses quite a few computer chips in cars nowadays, and it hasn't been a priority for the chip makers throughout all this, has meant that car makers have had to slow production at times, stop production of certain models, and it's really changed the top 10 cars. So, for example, there are cars coming in here, you know, that wouldn't normally be seen, and it's just because those are the cars that people can actually get their hands on. And that's also sent the cars of that's also sent the prices of used cars through the roof. I mean, we had used car inflation of something crazy like 30% at one point this year, because people couldn't buy new cars, and so that they were going out and buying used ones instead. To which your answer is, why don't they just keep hold of the car they've got? Well, their car they've got might have broken down. The car they've got might have been written off. The car they've got might no longer be suitable for them. Or actually what's happening for a lot of people is they're coming to the end of finance deals and they don't want to pay to buy that car. And so they're then going off and buying these new cars. And it's a fascinating little microcosm of the weird global inflation triggered by supply chain crunches and demand that has managed to be higher than people expected, and weird things like the fact that Tesla actually only managed to claim second spot due to a massive delivery of them in December, lumpy delivery, because incredibly at the end of November, the Model 3 wasn't even in the top 10. And then 9,612 Model 3s registered December alone, and it leapt into second spot. The Model 3 is being driven by the shift to electric cars, but also electric cars are very tempting for people to buy if they can get them through these salary sacrifice schemes at the moment where there's almost zero benefit in kind tax on it. So it's all quite an interesting little thing. And also the fact that the pandemic, rise of online shopping, changing the way we do things, what do you need in order to do that? Someone to deliver that stuff to your door. Mm. So what is their massive demand for? Vans. Why are they able to sell lots more vans? Well, I guess they're a bit more basic and they don't put so many computer chips in there. And maybe they're kind of prioritizing them and so on. But it's an interesting little tale, this. And I tell you something else interesting on this note. Hire car inflation. Now, you might have heard, if you're a regular listener to our podcast, you may have heard about hire car inflation here first. This sudden, insane rise in hire car prices that we first reported on last summer, triggered by friends, family, and members of This Is Money trying to hire cars and wondering why they were three times as expensive as they were the year before. Mm-hmm. Well, I had a car hire booked for the start of February in Zurich, when I'm hoping to fly to Switzerland, then drive to Austria to go snowboarding. I live in hope. Still. And it cost me about two and a half to three times what it cost me the last time I did this, which I didn't get to go last year, but was the start of 2020. Similar weekend, similar length of time. So I had to pay, and I booked in November, I had to pay £325 for the car. I was looking around at stuff for another holiday yesterday, another potential holiday, and I just thought, I'll just quickly check those car hire prices to see whether they've changed. I have now been able to rent a car for the same 3 days for £175. That's similar car. It's £150 cheaper. Yeah. So I've cancelled the first one and hired the second one. So there you go. Maybe the car hire companies have got, they're either suffering from a wave of cancellations or they're actually now finally starting to get the deliveries of their cars. So a little tip to anyone who has booked car hire for a holiday in the future and winced at the price of it, go check those car hire prices again, because it might be worth you doing what I did. Mm. Talk about worrying that you were going to cancel the wrong one though.
Yeah, no, indeed. Yeah, exactly. What does 2022 look like, very briefly, Simon, for used car market, the new car market and the hire car market?
Okay, so the boss of one of the biggest dealerships, Lookers, has basically said that the used car market is defying economic reality or something along those lines. So I wouldn't bet on the used car market managing to pull off the same trick in 2022 that it did in 2021. The used car dealerships have been making money hand over fist on used cars, boost their revenues, you know, so then that boosts their sales. They're struggling to get hold of cars is the problem. I think we're going to see some big deliveries of new cars. We're going to see the car market go a bit back to normal. And I wouldn't be surprised to see the Ford Fiesta back near top spot.
Right. All right, there you go. Heard it here first. Finally, as the Great Resignation looks set to continue into 2022 and the majority of employers planning to recruit staff, professionals who are looking for a new challenge could see plenty of opportunities. But in which sectors will those opportunities be most abundant? Where are the top paying jobs and how do you bag them? Lee, firstly, why are people quitting? Where are they going? The Great Resignation, will it continue?
I think people, there's a few things at play. I think firstly, you know, as there is many years, people there's a lot of people looking for a new challenge, you know, might have had more time to reflect on their life and their career and might be looking to try something new. Then there's always the classic looking for more money, you know, which is basically why a lot of people jump jobs. And also people might be looking for a more hybrid way of working that their place of work might not be offering at the moment. Now, if you are someone that's looking to retrain or do something different, I thought this was a really interesting piece of data. It was really robust, actually, because they interviewed 22,000 professionals, got a real snapshot of employers as well. Employers, 80% of employers are saying they're looking to take on staff this year, which, you know, it shows signs of a buoyant potential job market. It's just those jobs that are sometimes quite hard to fill because people might not have the qualifications yet, or you know, the skill set required. But the areas that they're saying this year that are kind of in demand and could be worth having a look at and offer above average salaries are in technology, marketing, construction and engineering. Now, drilling down into that, the number one thing that they're saying is cybersecurity specialists, which I think is really, it sounds like an interesting job to me. You know, maybe it's because of the profession that we're in, but it sounds like it's something that could be pretty interesting, I think. And there's a lot of younger people, I would suggest, that are probably coming into adulthood very well equipped to be cybersecurity specialists, you know, mainly because they've grown up first generation really to fully grow up with the internet and computers and devices and things. And I thought it was quite interesting that James Hanahan, the director of Hayes Technology of the UK, says that there are cybersecurity degrees across the UK, but that's not the most common route. And actually, he said, generally you find that people who want to work in cyber are the types of people that have learned to hack from 14 or 15 years old. Often these people won't go to university to study, but will probably be the best penetration testers as they've been learning about the sector from such a young age. So I think that that's quite interesting, but that doesn't mean if you're a little bit older that you can't go and get the skills required, you know, the soft skills, and you might have other kind of experience that could make you, you know, a worthy candidate to get into cybersecurity. Software engineers is number two in terms of salary. And then there's other things outside of technology. So maintenance engineers.
Thank God, because I'd be absolutely screwed, Lee.
Maintenance engineers. So these are the people who look after equipment and machinery in factories and industrial plants. Okay. And you can earn an average typical salary of £42,250. You know, so it's not just all technology, and then followed by electrical engineers at 41 grand. So it was a really interesting barometer, I thought, of A, the job market, B, what people are looking for, and C, the roles that are coming up at the moment. I mean, you'd suspect that cybersecurity is an industry that is just going to keep booming. I've seen all this chat this week of the metaverse and all of that stuff. I mean, that blows my mind. I mean, that actually blows my mind. I've been watching some of that stuff and reading about it, and I'm struggling to get my head around it. And I'm starting to think, God, is this what it was like to be, you know, in your mid-30s when the internet was blowing up and you couldn't quite get your head around it? I don't know. I was looking at this going, I don't get this. This is like the next level. But, you know, with that, is it, there lie job opportunities. And, you know, if you've got children or grandchildren, or perhaps you're a younger listener, you know, it's not a bad route, I would predict, to be looking down. And I think that you don't need a university degree. Typically, people don't have a university degree in cyber engineering or cyber security that go into it. I think it's interesting, especially for that salary level.
All right, then. All right. You can keep up to date with all the latest breaking money news. Just go to thisismoney.co.uk or download the app. And if you have any comments or questions for the team or anything you'd like them to look into, Simon?
You can email us at editor@thisismoney.co.uk. You can tweet us at thisismoney. And you can come to thisismoney.co.uk/podcast to find out all the podcasts past and join the debate with your comments.
And if you like our podcast, while we're waving goodbye to each other on Zoom, you can rate us on iTunes. It helps other people find us. If only you could see what we're doing right now.